Okay, I just want to say, so The Shape of Water, not, whatever, okay. Like, Carolyn just looked at me like, hey, this is such a Carolyn movie,
Don't
too.
Ever make presumptions about what I like and don't like, because you're usually going to be wrong.
Well, wow. Watch.
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode number 9. I'm your host, Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined by my motley crew, Carolyn Pettit.
Hey, hey.
And Ebony Astor.
What's up?
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love, or alternatively, we are the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending on your perspective. On today's show, we're going to check in with the latest pop culture news. We'll chat about interspecies love in Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. We'll talk about a web series called Her Story about the lives of trans women. And then we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Deal? And as always, exclusively for our fantastic drip backers, we'll be recording a bonus segment. In this week's very special bonus segment, Carolyn is going to treat us to a dramatic reading from Ready Player One. So y'all better sign up to be drip backers so you can get that
for
amazingness. As you've heard before, everything Feminist Frequency does, including this very podcast, is listener, reader, and fan supported. So thank you for helping us stay on the air and on the web. If you want access to special perks and exclusive backer rewards, go to our podcast community at d.rip/femfreak. Now on with the show. Hey, guess what?
Huh.
We record this podcast on Mondays.
Yes.
And today is Martin Luther King Day.
Hey.
It sure is.
Oh, that sounded weak. It's just because,
yeah,
I know, just because I'm sick. But all honor to the elder. All honor.
Yeah. I, you know, like every MLK Day comes around every year. And I feel like, you know, as the years go by, his work gets super
diluted.
I want to say, yeah,
decontextualized,
well, I
whitewashed,
and I kind of actually mean that, right?
Sanitized.
Yeah, super sanitized and corporatized. And, you know, like, I think it's really important that folks look at the things he said outside of what is palatable to
right.
a capitalist
yeah.
society. So, like, I was looking up some stuff last night and, like, dude was super anti-capitalist.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like,
he
and
was,
radical.
And he was
super
a political
radical, anti-capitalist,
yep.
anti-war, all this shit. And like, unless you actually dive into his work and what was going on, we're stuck with this sort of, you know, like the general conversation around like MLK was nonviolent and Malcolm X was violent. And that's just not like that's too simplistic.
And the other problem with it is that because the narrative about MLK that's been sold to, you know, that's sold to like school children, particularly to white school children across this country as they're growing up is that, you know, a symptom of that is like there are literally tweets today from Trump supporters,
right,
who honestly, literally believe that MLK would be on Trump's, like, would
right,
support
right.
Trump, right? Because in their minds, Trump is like doesn't see color or whatever,
yeah.
And also in their minds, MLK didn't see color, right? And so for them, that's like the ideal of what we're striving for, and it's just like it's so. It just makes my head want to explode when
yeah.
I
yeah,
see that.
Yeah, all day we're all gonna be, you know, peppered with, you know, that same like over the shoulder black and white image of Martin at the March on Washington with a caption from I Have a Dream, and that is literally all people know. You know, they haven't even listened to or read that whole speech, let alone any of his other more
right?
important work. You know,
yeah,
so
exactly.
I have. As much as I celebrate this day with my brothers and sisters in the struggle, it is always really tough to watch this day unfold on social media or listening to the just sort of wildly uncomplicated hagiographies of Martin that'll be on, like, you know, public radio or whatever. And they just don't bother to go into, you know, the nuance of who he was and the complexities of what he did, but yeah, also his radical side. So,
like, just briefly to speak on that, there is I think a bit of a social media pushback against that tremendous whitewashing and sanitizing. You know, I mean, I did retweet a tweet this morning from a felonious monk who says, quote, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. MLK was a repub. And then, like, stop right there. And there's an image of MLK saying, quote, call it democracy or call it democratic socialism, but there must be a better distribution of wealth within this country for all God's children.
Yeah.
So, like, right there, you know.
Absolutely.
Like, mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah. All right, y'all. Let's check in with some entertainment news.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't... Yeah, so this first is kind of tangentially entertainment. I mean, it's pop culture, it's public figures related. So this past week was a week of some, I guess you could say, backlash to the Me Too movement by some prominent older white women, you know, maybe in particular. for instance, Catherine Deneuve, the legendary French actor, was among many, many French women who signed a letter lamented, quote, the puritanical wave creating restrictions on free speech, consensual sexuality, and a lack of due process for the accused.
Man, lady's been hanging out on Reddit for too long.
Yeah, I mean, part of the letter reads, rape is a crime, but insistent or clumsy flirting is not a crime, nor is gallantry a chauvinist aggression. It went on to say that in the wake of the Harvey Weinstein allegations, freedom of speech has been turned on its head. So there's like all this concern.
Dude, this is like straight up 4chan bullshit.
It's exactly like this paranoia, this like image of a world in which like there's like no flirting, you know, or like that's what it's almost like they're trying to paint a picture that that's what we're on the road to, is like a world where sexuality itself is just like shut down. And, you know, it's ludicrous. It's this is a movement in pursuit of much healthier sexual relationships, much more consensual, you know, healthier.
And a complicated understanding of consent.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And this idea about insistent or clumsy flirting being a crime or not a crime, relevant to the next story I'm going to bring up. But also, not only Catherine Deneuve, but Margaret Atwood, a prolific writer, probably best known these days for having written the novel A Handmaid's Tale, you know, penned an op-ed for the Globe and Mail titled Am I a Bad Feminist? And again, it's very much concern about, like, the well-being of potential men being, like, wrongly accused rather than concern for women victims. You know, she says, the Me Too moment is a symptom of a broken legal system. You know, all too frequently, women and other sexual abuse complainants couldn't get a fair hearing through institutions, including corporate structures, so they used a new tool, the internet. This has been very effective and has been seen as a massive wake-up call. But what next? If the legal system is bypassed because it is seen as ineffectual, what will take its place? Who will be the new power brokers? It won't be the bad feminists like me. We are acceptable neither to the right nor to left. In times of extremes, extremists win. Their ideology becomes a religion. Anyone who doesn't puppet their views is seen as an apostate, a heretic, or a traitor, and moderates in the middle are annihilated. So, again, like...
God, this is so enraging to listen to.
I know. Like,
You know, one thing that I was thinking about as you were saying that is, you know, in the discussions around online harassment, there's so much focus on laws and the legalities of it. When I'm here being like, yo, most of online harassment is not illegal, nor should it ever be illegal by definition of the law, but it can still create harm.
Yes.
And like, laws are not always good. Laws can be fucking racist as shit, and like that's why they are changing. And so I think like the Catherine Deneuve stating that this is about like legality or not legality, that is not the definition to which we need to define how harm happens,
right?
Or like who, what harm looks like.
Yes, yeah, exactly. To be fair, Deneuve did issue a statement just today or last night, within the past several hours, sort of saying that she stands by the statement in the letter, but apologizing to basically, she says, I fraternally salute all women victims of odious acts who may have felt aggrieved by the letter in Le Monde. It is to them and them alone that I apologize. So she's like, I'm not changing my position or anything, but if you felt upset by what the letter said, I'm sorry. Like one of those kind of apologies.
Did she use the phrase fraternally?
Because that's very interesting.
That's very interesting, right? Like that word, like brotherhood, like in brotherhood, right?
That's just very interesting. That too.
Whatever. Yeah. My feeling on Deneuve and all of the other, you know, French folks who signed that letter, and Margaret Atwood, who Mallory Ortberg called her the Canadian Joyce Carol Oates, and I lost my mind. I was laughing so hard. But anyway, second waiver is going to second wave is all I have to say about that. You know, I'm so tired of people parsing to the nth degree exactly where criminality lies and where we should, like, you know, how we should define trauma and cite it and who's allowed to claim it, right? Because we do the same thing with racism, such that if you are not, in fact, holding a high pressure hose and sicking a police dog on someone and saying, you know, darkies go home, then everything else is assumed to not actually be racist, you know? So if you don't actually, you know, hold someone down and brutally rape them, that's not, you know, everything up to that is fine. Fuck that. Miss me with that. Miss it. Also, you know what? Insistent flirting? No, I don't want that. Okay. You know, insistent flirting?
That fucking language.
I actually am wildly against that, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So speaking of that kind of, like, I guess you could say insistent attitude about expecting kind of female bodies and sexuality to be available to you, mm-hmm. A story broke on Babe this past week about a woman's really unpleasant experience with Aziz Ansari. And she it's actually kind of difficult to read the piece that details their encounter, because it so often comes to moments where she makes it very, very clear through, like, either verbal but often through, like, nonverbal cues that she's not interested in what's happening, or she's not participating, she doesn't want it to happen. And yet, you know, he sort of, it's as if he's completely either, you know, blind to those cues or, like, ignoring them, mm-hmm. right? Like, just as one small example, he sort of repeatedly keeps taking her hand and moving it to his crotch. And, like, she'll pull it away and he'll, like, pull it back. And it's just, like, again and again and again. And that's a motif that repeats itself throughout the story, is her making it, like, sending signals in some way that she doesn't want something to happen, and him still putting pressure for it to happen. And, you know, you get a lot of men responding to things like this with, like, well, why doesn't she just, like, say no or whatever? And even though she does at times in so many words, like, women, you know, shouldn't have to, like, I mean, if I don't understand, it's, like, literally impossible almost for me to understand how a person can keep going when the person you're with is so clearly, like, not in their body.
Unless that is part of what turns you on. Unless that is actually part of it, right? Like, the need to conquer someone, the need to, like, convince someone, the need to overcome their defenses, you know? Unless that's bound up in it. It's hard for us, you know, reasonable people to think, like, why would anyone want to be in a sexual encounter with someone that we have to cajole, you know, or intimidate into doing this? But we know that there are real consequences for women when they give what's called the hard no, right? And you never know when those consequences may rebound on you. So the fact that women sometimes have to resort to, oftentimes have to resort to communicating non-verbally, trying to deflect attention, trying to, you know, gradually kind of extricate themselves without giving that hard no, is the way that we have learned, simply so that we can survive, because we never know when actually asserting ourselves explicitly and vocally is going to come back to haunt us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, like, this is rape culture. I sincerely believe that men like Aziz in these situations don't, like, consciously know what they're doing is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that this is not an excuse, like, there's nothing forgivable about the situation, but I think that it's part of rape culture where men think that that is how relationship and sexual experiences happen, and, like, the media does a shit, like, so not to, like, pick on him, but the no yes trope is when men are the insistent flirting over and over and over, and they fucking did that shit on an episode of Parks and Rec, and I was so mad. I have big issues with his character on Parks and Rec in general, but it's that we see it all the time, right? The stalking as romance, all of this
it's
shit.
It's this whole perception of sexual flirting and sexual, you know, relationships that has to fundamentally change in our culture.
Yeah, oh, totally. And like, you know, there's the thing that's pissing me off too about this is that the men who are considered like progressive or, you know, like Aziz and what's his name?
Louis C.K. Is that?
Well, the politician. Why am I blanking on his name right now?
Al Franken.
Al Franken, thank you.
Oh, right.
Like people are coming to their defense and being like, but they're good guys. I'm like, no. Like, I don't care what your politics are. If you're fucking harming women, you're shitty. And, like, you need to step up more. And you need to actually, like, repair the harm that you've done. So, like, we need to be really careful that this doesn't fall on, like, party lines, so to speak.
Right,
that, like,
right.
this is never acceptable, no matter who it is.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
On that note, let's talk about The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Oh, boy, okay. is my intro to The Shape of Water. My friends, lead us in, Anita. Give me some time to collect my emotions.
Sorry, I know. I think we're all a little like, eh. Okay, I just want to say, so The Shape of Water, whatever. Okay. Carolyn just looked at me like, hey, this is such a Carolyn movie,
Don't ever make presumptions about what I like and don't like, because you're usually going to be wrong.
No, that's not true, because I can see that Carolyn would like this movie. Okay. There's things about it that are so, like, up your alley and so not up my alley.
Right.
But just for context, The Shape of Water is a film by Guillermo del Toro, who is, you know, a really well-known filmmaker. He made Pacific Rim and Pan's Labyrinth, among other things. The film is about...
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
Francis stole Pee-wee's bike.
Basically, the film's about fucking a...
Oh, my God.
Fucking a fish man.
It is not about... I mean, that is like a metaphor. That is a metaphor for people who feel and who live like outside the margins.
Yeah, I know.
Seeing the beauty in each other and finding love with each other.
Yeah, yeah. All right. That's fair. Okay, so let's dive into it. I will not be the first to express my opinion then.
Oh, man.
Although I might be too late for that.
So I went to go see the movie last night, and I had wanted to see it. I'm a Guillermo del Toro fan. Have loved his work.
As listeners to the Discovery podcast know, you're an admirer of
Doug Jones.
What up, my boy? Listen,
who plays the fish man?
Exactly. Listen, the fact that I hadn't seen it already was a surprise because I am a big Doug Jones booster. But I was weirdly reluctant to see this movie for some reason I couldn't quite determine, and I realize now it was my subconscious protecting me because I had forgotten. Okay, let me back up here. I have to do this in every episode, right? I have to back up and explain myself and tell people you should probably mute this podcast for the next 2 minutes as I go on one of my patented hater rants.
Ebony's patented hater rant.
I'm a hater, all right?
These are so great. Don't mute
them. I am immune to whimsy, okay? I am immune to it. I am not charmed by it. There were times when I was watching this movie where I felt like I was watching Emily, a movie that I hated. It drives me bananas, and I'll tell you why. And I feel partially bad for what I'm about to say, but Sally Hawkins just kept me completely out of this movie. Her sort of twee, bird-like, timid, it's precisely the kind of affect that drives me nuts. So where many people I wish this was filmed because if people could see Carolyn reacting to what I'm saying, they would be like, cage fight.
Unbelievable.
I loved Richard Jenkins in this movie. Michael Shannon, always great, but Sally Hawkins makes my brain banana soup. Could not deal.
You're the worst, Ebony. No.
I am the worst.
No, I mean, I think Sally Hawkins' performance is wonderful. I think she does a fantastic job of revealing the inner life of this character who cannot speak. You know, it's a tremendously controlled production, right? It is like the production design is so immaculate. Everything about the colors and everything, the murky greens of her like apartment kind of mimicking or reflecting the water in which the fish man lives, for lack of a better term, fish man. And I did feel at times that it was too controlled. It was too like restrained. And I wanted it to be a little more, to have a little more what I feel like is just the sort of, I don't know, spontaneous energy of real life or something like that. But, you know, the love story at the heart of it, I thought was really beautiful.
Of course you did.
I mean,
Carolyn is not afraid of having real human emotions. Carolyn. I know.
I mean, there's one line that the Sally Hawkins character says. I remember her last name, Esposito, but I don't remember her first name. Anyway, she says of the fish man, she says, the creature. Let's say the creature.
No, he's the fish man.
Okay, she says, like, the way he looks at me, he doesn't know what I lack or how I am incomplete. He sees me as I am. So contrast that with, so the Michael Shannon character, there's one like horrifying scene where we see him at home having sex with his wife, mm-hmm. and she's like speaking and he keeps saying, silence, silence. And so he fetishizes Sally Hawkins's silence. There's mm-hmm. a scene in which he is kind of like coming on to her or revealing his attraction to her, and it's specifically because she's mute. Like, that is what attracts him to her. And I guess in that moment, those like two different kind of connections with male figures kind of reminded me in a way of like most of the, you know, and I'm gonna get a little personal, like most of the like romantic or flirtatious attention I get in the world is from like creeper dudes who I immediately can tell are purely interested in me because I'm trans. Like, that is it. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know me as a person, they don't know anything, but they are like fetishizing my transness. And I'm just not, like, I as a person cannot have a romantic connection with somebody. Like, that's not for me gonna mm-hmm. work. Like, I need somebody who, you know, as she uses it, like, quote, sees me as I am. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, like, was part of why it just struck a chord on a really personal level. And certainly, like, relatability mm-hmm. is not, like, there's discussions happening right now that in criticism circles and in evaluating works of art, like, too much emphasis is being placed on, like, relatability. And I actually agree with that. Like, I don't think that relatability is, like, a mark of a work of art's greatness or anything. So I'm not saying that the fact that I could relate to it in this way makes it, like, great. But I'm saying, like, it worked for me on that level. Like, yeah. I did find that really heartwarming and hopeful, I guess, in a way.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that I had the precisely the opposite reaction. So, yes, I'm a hater, but the reason why I was not invested in the relationship between Sally's character and the fishman was because we actually saw very little of them coming to know each other. So we saw her, you know, bringing him hard-boiled eggs, which made me want to puke. But so she's bringing him hard-boiled eggs, and she's playing Benny Goodman, and she's, you know, schlepping her record player there. But for me, mm-hmm. it seemed as if she was doing the same thing to him to a lesser degree and in a different way that Michael Shannon's character was doing to her, such that she was investing him with the qualities that she needed. But the communication seemed in many ways one-sided. So we never get a sense of his interior life, you know, and we never get a sense of the fish man, you know, slowly coming to love Sally's character in his own fishy way. What we see is the need that he fulfills for her. So I just, you know, it felt like, okay, I'm about to say something that is going to make people think, oh my God, this is the most ludicrous parody of a feminist response to a film ever. But I really just felt like he was kind of coerced into that relationship. Like, she was the one person who was being nice to him. She was bringing him, you know, those hard-boiled eggs every day. What was he going to do? Not be friendly to her? It wasn't as if he had a choice of people to connect with or other creatures to connect with, and he chose her. She was literally his only option. And she was also, you know, like, his one choice to be saved. So, yes, I believe that they did share a connection, but I just didn't see enough of it from his point of view to demonstrate to me that it was a true, like, meeting of souls, whatever, you know,
that's totally fair. Yeah.
So I didn't actually know what I was watching when I walked into the theater. Like, I just knew it was a Guillermo del Toro movie. I didn't know what it was about. And so that was an interesting way to experience this film.
Yeah.
I thought it was fucking boring. Like, just, I was like, when is this movie going to end? I thought the pacing was awful. But it's beautiful. And I think that I was like, I was held into it for much longer than I normally would be because of how absolutely stunning it is. That intro sequence where they're like floating in the water in the apartment, I thought was just unbelievably gorgeous. I loved the design of the fish man. I loved the eyes.
Yeah.
Like the flicking of the eyes. Shout out Doug Jones. So all of that was really lovely. But I think that, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Del Toro's work in general, from what I've seen of it, not all of it. And I felt like it was just so, the story is not subtle or nuanced. Like, I think that he makes really great, beautiful films that just have fucking boring stories to me. So it's this band of outsiders that I felt like it was just everything about it was beating me over the head, and there was no subtlety, right? There's the misogynist dude, there's these outsiders coming together, there's a fucking Russian spy for some goddamn reason, like, to complicate things or whatever. And then the whole time I'm sitting there being like, are they gonna fuck? They're gonna fuck. Are they gonna fuck? Ugh. Are they gonna fuck? And there's this quote. So A.O. Scott from the New York Times really liked the film a lot, and there's this quote in their review that says, "You may marvel at just how far Mr. Del Toro takes his interspecies romance all the way, basically, and also at how natural and how uncreepy and how pure and right he makes it seem. And why not? Hard disagree. Mm-hmm. I do not agree that it seemed natural and uncreepy. It was fucking weird and creepy and like." Whatever. I'm just putting that out
there. It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor.
I don't care. I watched a woman. Well, so then at the end. Okay, spoiler alert, because we haven't really. Whatever. Spoiler alert, because for the very, very end. When you figure out that she, like, so she has these gills, right? You see that it might be, and then in the water, it's actually revealed that they do pop out.
No, the fish man, because the fish man has this, like, healing power, right? Earlier, he puts his hand.
Wait, so she's not a fish person?
No, those were the scars that led to her being mute, her vocal cords being
cut. Oh, God, so this makes it worse, because at the end, I was like, oh, well, so that was, like, this latent thing about her being weird, and then so now, like, it's not this weird interspecies thing. She actually was a fish person all the time, too.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
That is
because I was
amazing.
Trying to give it something. All right, fuck this movie.
Oh my god.
Wait, no, okay, so just three things. So one thing, and these are all superficial because that's who I am. One, I never got over the fact that Strickland, Michael Shannon's character, didn't wash his hands after going to the bathroom. I was horrified.
That's
about
how you know a misogynist is bad.
Yeah, I could not get past it. You know, I wanted to walk out of the theater. I was so grossed out, which was the point. Two, when the fish man and Sally's character, why can't I remember her name? When they get it on this, like,
Eliza?
The second time.
I think it was Eliza.
Yes, Eliza. Okay, so when they get it on the second time and she floods the bathroom, I was so pissed. I was like, that is not your building. That is not your house. You are wrecking things for other people.
Totally.
Also, I liked it better when they did that in the movie Delicatessen. I thought it worked better then than I'm seeing it now.
I think you are applying the rules of reality too strongly to what is clearly intended to be a kind of fantasy film.
Sure. Okay, so I'll say, so Ebony said she doesn't like whimsical stuff. I definitely like whimsical stuff, especially when it's like the subtle faux realism that comes in. Like, that's just really small amounts of whimsy and magic in an otherwise, like, normal space, I guess.
Yeah.
I think that, like, so it's easier for Evan and I to, like, pick all these pieces apart because we didn't get emotionally invested in the story, right? And so we're, like, we're sitting here, like, struggling through getting through this. And so you see all of these pieces that you're like, man, you're going to ruin the goddamn building. Like, I was with you, right? Mm. Like, I was just like, all right, at this point, when is this movie going to end? But it was nominated for a bajillion Golden Globes. Like,
It's critically widely acclaimed.
Yeah, like, I think that Evan and I are super in the, like, the...
In the minority here,
in terms of, like, not liking the film, and I appreciate what it's doing, but again, like, it just
didn't work.
I want more nuance in my storytelling.
Yeah,
and
I
this
agree.
Just it beat me over the this, head, and I was like, "Fucking shut up!"
I definitely agree that the stuff with the, like, Octavia Spencer character and the
Giles,
Richard Jenkins character, like, was very much like, look there, he's gay, she's black, you know, but it's sort of like trying to make those parallels, and yet also, you know, kind of doing that thing where it's marginalizing the characters or the people who are living the issues that it's kind of trying to comment on. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, like when an X-Men story, people say, oh, but it's so much like, obviously it's like about race or whatever, but like 90% of the X-Men are white, are like white people.
Right.
There's just one line, though, that that really stuck, besides the lines I already quoted, one line that I thought was really excellent and did stay with me, which is, Eliza's trying to get, is the name Giles? Giles?
It's Giles or Giles.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Trying to get him to kind of come along with her on her plan, and he's, like, mm-hmm. reluctant. And she says to him, if we do nothing, then neither are we.
Right.
And I just thought that such such a interestingly kind of poetic way of phrasing the need to do something about, like, injustice.
Yeah, totally.
Carol, can I ask you a question?
I think there was... Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, sure. I just wanted to ask Carol a question, because obviously you had a very different reaction to the movie than I did, and I think you probably had a different reaction to this scene, too. The daydream that Sally has, where she sings and dances, and where she suddenly has a voice.
Yes, yeah.
And, you know, it becomes this, you know, kind of black and white, you know, golden age of Hollywood fantasy, where she's, you know, telling... the fish man, like, you'll never know how much I love you, right? And it was this very beautiful moment, but I was very uncomfortable with the fact that we were hearing what started off as her voice and then sounded as if it was, you know, another singer's voice, right? But I was very uncomfortable with that. And, you know, I don't know if the reason why I was uncomfortable is something that's shared by people in, like, the disabled community or whatever, but I was just like... Sure. I don't like, want her to use this other method of communication when she's so effective and moving with her hands and with her gestures and with her expressions. I just don't see that this would have been. It sat weirdly with me. I don't know. What did you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. Like, she obviously, she loves movies. She watches them at, like, Giles' place all the time, and she doesn't know what her own voice sounds
right,
like, right? So
right.
her vision. Her, like, fantasy idea of her own voice is might well be taken from the voice of the singer actor in the film that she watches all the time or whatever. So in that sense, it kind of worked for me as her, like, you know, living that fantasy for a moment of having a really beautiful singing voice that happens to be the one that from the film. But I agree that it's, I mean, I see the complication that you're raising there.
Yeah, because, like, you know, if she were, say she were a paraplegic, for instance, right? And then she had a fantasy whereby she had the use of her legs, I would feel uncomfortable with that because disabled people don't feel as if they're insufficient, right? You know?
Right, right. I think...
And they don't get, and also they don't get cast in those roles.
Well, right.
Yeah.
Right.
Which
is why they can do
that. I guess I saw it as coming out of her desire to... Mm-hmm. To communicate, but right. I mean, it's it's complicated.
Yeah. we all watched a 6-part web series called Her Story, which was actually nominated for an Emmy last year. Mm. I think it came out in 2016.
Yeah.
It was directed by Sydney Freeland. And I'm just going to read the description that they give on the site about what it's about. Her story is about two trans women in Los Angeles who have given up on love when suddenly chance encounters give them hope. Violet is drawn to Allie, a reporter who approaches her for an interview, while career-driven Paige meets James, the first man she's considered opening up to in years. Will they risk letting what they are stand in the way of being loved for who they are? Bum, bum, bum.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
It stars Jen Richards as Violet. Jen Richards is a trans actor and activist. She sort of campaigns for better trans representation in the media.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wanted us to have more, like, look at web series and look at, like, indie creators on this podcast and maybe shout out some and, you know, that sort of thing. So I suggested we watch this one. I hadn't heard of it. I just Googled a bunch of, like, what are the best, like, most acclaimed web series. And and this one seemed like an interesting place for us to have a conversation with.
Yeah. And I mean, I'll say, you know, although I think it's somewhat amateurish in the storytelling in the sense that I could feel it kind of like raising and checking off like this issue and that issue and that issue, like, oh, this conversation around trans issues or that conversation. Obviously, like, I admire it. Like, I you know, I'm rooting for Vi, right? Like, I can kind of relate. So again, like, to do the relatability thing. So, you know, I don't want to, like, spoil too much, but as we've heard from the description, like, there's, Vi is drawn to, what's her name?
Allie.
Like, and so they have this conversation at one point, right, where Allie says, like, trying to explain, where Vi trying to explain to Allie, like, what her internal experience of being trans is like. She says, you know, something like, so they're sitting at a table at, like, a restaurant or cafe or something. And she says, like, I'm spending a lot of this conversation, like, noticing how big my hands are, wondering if people are clocking my voice. It's hard to feel totally present with all of that. You know, and when she said that, I was like, yes, you know, exactly. Like, I could, that was definitely something I can relate to, is this sense of, like, always a certain amount of energy going to, like, the awareness of, you know, like, I know I don't have, like, passing privilege, so I'm, like, always aware and sort of navigating the fact that people around me know I'm trans and how are they going to react to that, and it's exhausting. Like, it's exhausting to always, and as she says, like, it's hard to be present that way. It's like, yes, like, it's hard to be fully present in the moment when it's as if some part of your mind is always kind of aware of those kinds of things, you know?
Yeah, totally.
There were parts of this show that I really liked. For one, like, Paige. I loved Paige's character. I loved the, like, I think that that actor is just an amazing actor, and I loved, like, I often get frustrated with kind of the sassy black character in shows, but for sure. Me, Paige worked and on this one a lot, and I really loved watching the progression of her relationship. So, you know, we see her have, you know, like, at the tail end of a sexual encounter with someone who then, you know, bounces out, and then she meets James and, you know, blah, 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 right? But I loved Paige. I did wonder, though, like, the scenes with Allie and her friends felt weird to me, and I don't know if they should, but I just felt like these conversations, they're acting as if none of them have ever heard or met, right, or thought about, you know, trans people before. And I'm like, okay, granted, I'm not hanging out in middle-class, white, lesbian-only spaces, but I can't imagine that y'all are hearing about this shit for the first time through this one person in the City of Angels. I was just like, this read really false to me, and it read really, you know, as a way, like, the story, yeah, constructed this as a way to have these kind of, like, 101 conversations.
Right.
And I also felt like, it felt, I wanted the kind of primary perspective of the show to be Vi's, but it felt like it set up so that it was Allie's. And I was like, yeah, okay, whatever. But I felt like we should have started with Violet, you know, and her interiority, rather than learning about her through the way that Allie sees her. I think I would have felt more satisfied, if that makes sense, with a kind of shift and how the short series was framed. We do get more of Vi, you know, as the six episodes progress, but it still felt as if, you know, this was kind of Allie's story in a way. And, you know, she starts, yeah, off by wanting to interview this, you know, very interesting woman that she's met about this issue. She starts to learn more, you know, and then become attracted to her. And, you know, they wrestle with that, whatever. But it still felt like she was the kind of viewpoint character in a lot of ways. And I just wasn't that interested in her. I was more interested in Violet.
Especially for a show that is billing itself as about two trans women, I feel like, like, Paige was kind of sidelined in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And like, I agree that I thought Allie's character was obnoxious, and I felt like the acting was really bad, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so I kept getting pulled out. Like, I 100% agree with all of this. Like, it is a very heavy-handed series, but there are some moments that I really,
yeah,
like, where you're like, oh, I want more of this,
absolutely,
right? Where this,
absolutely,
levity comes out, yeah, or, like, you know, they're able to weave in, the sort of morals that they're trying to get without being heavy-handed. But again, like you were saying, those conversations with, like, the queer, like the white lesbian, mm-hmm, community, or, you know, they weren't all white, but I'm just like, oh my god,
yeah.
And
I was just
like, and your friends are transphobic as fuck. Like,
yeah,
drop,
like,
their,
yeah,
exactly,
right,
exactly. Like,
like,
don't try and redeem them. Like, these people are trash. And at the end. And at the end, yeah, when I think it was Lisa who outed Paige, you know, very publicly,
well,
right?
We're trying to have a non-spoiler conversation.
What? I'm sorry. Okay. Our editor will have to beat that
too
out.
Too late.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, folks. I'm the worst.
No, no. Just keep going. So, keep going. It's all right.
At the end, when there's like the sort of big, you know, climactic moment, Paige says to Allie, I think to Allie, listen, just because these issues are new to you, they're old to me. And I appreciated that, you know, like the amount of learning and unpaid emotional labor that people ask people of color to do, queer folks to do, the disabled community to do, you know, like, oh, teach me about this. Convince me of your humanity. You know, give me the tools to argue this amongst my friends. And it's like, you know what? Sometimes we're just tired. Sometimes we don't do your own work. You know, like, yeah, we do this all day, every day. And so just because this is the first time you're hearing about these things doesn't mean it's the first time I'm hearing about them. And it also doesn't mean that I collect a check for, you know, for educating you.
That was one of my favorite parts, and actually something like the top of my notes is that exact moment where you see like the other people, like Allie is enraged. We are enraged as the viewers, and Paige is like just calm and like, this is how it goes. And I got to have this fucking annoying conversation with this guy who's going to drop my ass because I didn't talk about, like, he doesn't know that I'm trans yet. And like, I like that resonated so deeply in terms of like both sides of that, right? In terms of like when you have privilege, watching people be harmed that you care about, and watching like watching the oppression as an outsider and a bystander is fucking enraging and hard. And I think that a lot of folks with privilege don't know how to channel that energy and they make situations worse. And then the person who is so like, who is the one that is being oppressed and the one that is being harmed is like, I've fucking done this for years, man. Like, let's just, it's, I get it. And I think that is a tension that a lot of people who are like newly woke, for lack of a better word, don't quite know how to navigate and handle.
To me, overall, this was like a way more, if we're going to compare apples and oranges, like a way more unsubtle, heavy-handed piece of media than Shape of Water.
Well, like, sure, I don't think you can compare them.
Well, I mean, you know, I just, but like, and there was one, I mean, overall, though, I mean, as I said, I admired this, I like this, I encourage people to seek it out, to watch it. There was one question Vi asks at one point that I thought was like really, I don't know, I mean, again, like well-meaning on the writer's part that she would ask it so they can sort of have that, but also like felt like, are you a trans woman transitioning in like the early 1980s? Because she asks Paige, do you think liking a woman makes me less of one? And I'm like, really, would a woman, like even a trans woman in the queer community of Los Angeles, have any concerns that like being that that being gay or liking a woman would make you less of a woman? Like, I just, I don't know. To me, that seemed sort of like, I don't believe that a person with Vi's lived experience would still have that particular like insecurity, I guess. You know what I mean?
I have no idea. I was like, okay, maybe that's a thing. Like,
I mean, maybe
as
it
I was
is.
Watching, I was like, maybe that's a thing.
Maybe it is.
For folks, and to me, I was like, I don't know. I will say that I think one of the things, I think it did try to tackle a lot of shit, and it didn't know how, and like, it was not subtle at all.
Right. I mean, but like, I knew, sorry, but just from the first, like, one of the first interactions in this show is, it's Allie with one of her, lesbian friends, who the really turfy one, and you know, Allie says like something like, "Do you think is that woman trans or something?" And the woman says, "No, she's all woman," like meaning she's cis, and then like immediately, deliberately like misgendering Vi, and I'm like, whoa, you know, yeah, okay, we're just like diving right in to this stuff. Okay,
I also just want to say that like the I think that there, I wish that it had focused on a particular area, issue area, because there's something, I think there's a really valuable conversation to have about like dating as a trans person.
Oh my God, absolutely.
I feel kind of like an asshole bringing this up. But like when, like, do you have to out yourself, quote unquote? When do you do that? Like, how do you use dating apps? I think that these are the kinds of like privilege points that cis people don't ever think about, because there is very real danger and harm in these situations. And also, like, having someone like you and then find out you're trans and then not like you, like, right. What,
oh my
like,
God.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Right. And so I wish that there's, because it was about dating, I wish there was a little bit more of that in here.
Yeah.
And the complications.
I actually, I really liked, I mean, liked is the wrong term, but I appreciated the fact that we do see some of the, like, multiple kind of intersecting issues that can make up a person, particularly people who, you know, exist in these really vulnerable spaces. So Vi, you know, is a former addict. You know, she is an abuse survivor. And I just thought, you know, yeah, that did feel really weird to me, real to me. It didn't, in the course of six short episodes, we don't get to tease a lot of that out. But yeah, just the reality that for many people, particularly, you know, many people in these, you know, vulnerable subject categories, there are kind of multiple intersecting issues that affect their day-to-day lives that many people don't. They are privileged to not have to experience.
Yeah, totally. So the web series is called Her Story. You can find it at herstoryshow.com, I believe. Check it out. You know, like, I think that there's value to it.
It's short. It's
six episodes.
Yeah, like like 8 to 10 minute episodes. Right. So it's like as long as one episode of an hour long TV show.
You know, like, I you know, support indie creators trying to do things, good media things.
Hang on a second. I have a call coming in.
Hey, Ebony. This is your producer, Phil. I heard that something's going on with the What's Your Deal segment.
Yeah, so here's what happened. A listener wrote in, and they had a better title, but I'm not ready to let the old title go, so...
What's this new title called?
What's Your Freak Out?
That is a better title, Ebony.
I know.
How about this? Just for this week, we'll have it... What's Your Freak Out Deal?
Yo, I love it. I love it. Let me try it out.
What's Your Freak Out Deal?
Ebony, let's start with you. What is your deal / freak out today?
Okay, so I am freaking out about Black Bolt, which
Oh, it works so well. It works so well.
Hey, yes. I don't I'm cool with it. If you think What's Your Deal was gonna be the last title I suggested during the course of this show, you are incredibly mistaken. I have bullshit for days, Anita. I always have something new in my pocket. So I'm happy to give you What's Your Freak Out. So yeah, I'm freaking out about Saladin Ahmed's Black Bolt series for Marvel. So just a little history with me. I come to this as a hardcore science fiction and fantasy fan. But through that fandom, I have read, you know, very, like, I'm not a comics reader. I don't read a lot of graphic novels. And I always wanted to. But honestly, I felt a little intimidated. I think for reasons that a lot of people in my position feel intimidated. One, you know, you just don't see a lot of people like me, which is not to say that Black women don't read comics. Of course they do. But you just don't. It feels like when you go into the comic store, you're the only one. You know that you're not, but you feel like, you know, like all eyes are on you. There's also the kind of barrier to entry that, you know, hardcore true fans put up for newbies, where it's like, if you don't know all the history of a character, you know, you're kind of illegitimate as a reader, as a fan, right? So it just combined to make it really hard for me to choose and feel okay with, like, dipping my toes in. Anyways, I finally let that shit go. I've been a fan of Saladin Ahmed purely from his Twitter feed. Get into it. We'll post the link. We'll post his handle. And I was finally like, you know what? Yeah, so I want to read this dude. And I don't care if it takes me a little while to get acclimated, to figure out who this Black Bolt character is. But I'm going to get into it. And I've been loving it. So Black Bolt is the leader of the Inhumans. Like I said, it's a Marvel run. And I'm absolutely loving it. So check it out.
Yeah. Awesome. That sounds awesome. All right, Carol, what is your freak out deal?
I'm freaking out about AGDQ, or Awesome Games Done Quick. It happened last week. It's an annual speedrunning marathon. AGDQ raises money for the Prevent Cancer Foundation. They did, you know, they raised a ton of money. It's a week-long speedrunning marathon. But what it was especially, and I love speedrunning. To me, speedrunning is so beautiful. If you're not familiar, speedrunning is where players try to get through games or accomplish certain goals in games as quickly as possible. And often that means exploiting all kinds of glitches or, you know, doing things in the game that the players are not intended to do. And I find that, like, really kind of oddly beautiful at times to see players figure out ways to, like, clip through walls or just, you know, skip a cutscene that you're not supposed to be able to skip or whatever. But what was also particularly meaningful about this year's AGDQ is, like, for a few years now, you know, there have been an increasing number of trans and genderqueer people, like, participating in AGDQ as runners. And the Twitch chat would just become, like, flooded with so much transphobic garbage, you know? And this year, one thing that they did at GDQ is they put the Twitch chat on subscriber-only mode, which cut down tremendously on the garbage and the transphobic BS in the Twitch chat. But really, it's just, like, it's so clear to me by the fact that, like, each year, you know, trans and genderqueer folks have a very strong presence at GDQ. The GDQ is, and the speedrunning community broadly, obviously not entirely, but broadly speaking, is, like, embracing that and is not, like, giving in to the haters, you know, and who are, you know, I mean, who are numerous and vocal and who take to Twitter and stuff to complain about, like, trans people in their speedrunning marathon or whatever. And AGDQ just, you know, basically isn't having it. They're standing strong. And so for me as a trans woman, just to see trans folks in this event that I already am so inclined to love, to see them being very clear about their position on this issue is, you know, it makes it all the easier for me to, like, enjoy and this event and encourage people to watch it.
Nice.
Awesome.
That's so awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. My deal this week
Your
is,
freak out, I believe you mean.
My freak out. But it's not a freak out, but it is. Well, it is. So, okay. So it's kind of weird. I don't know why. Whatever. I went out on Saturday night. I'm not, like, a going out kind of person.
Like on a date, like, Anita?
No. Oh. Like, I went, like,
then I'm 70% less interested. Go on.
Yeah, well, I probably wouldn't share on our podcast if I went out on a date.
Maybe,
but that's
okay.
That's
for season two. That's for the bonus.
Yeah, great. Anita's Dating Life podcast would be fucking bonkers and boring. But whatever. Saturday night. So I had tickets to go see a band called Ozo Motley. And then
I have heard of Ozo Motley.
So a friend of mine was coming into town for the SF sketch comedy thing that's happening for the last 2 weeks or whatever. Mm. And she was performing, and I was like, oh, shit, like, how do I do both of these things? So I went to a comedy show and I went to a concert all in one night, which, holy shit, I'm old. And that was, like, real intense. Comedy show was Liz Winstead, who is amazing and a friend of mine, and she runs the Lady Parts Justice League, which raises money for abortion clinics, and Lori Kilmartin, who I had never heard of or seen before. I'm not big in the comedy world. They were fucking hilarious and wonderful, and you should definitely check them out if they are ever performing near you. And I was just sitting there being like, this is a giant packed room full of people laughing their asses off because women are funny, right? Like, the whole thing about women not being funny. And there was a particular joke that Liz said that stuck with me in this weird way, where in her joke, she talks about how going to the as cis women going to the gynecologist and, like, you stick your legs in the fucking stirrups, and then no matter how far I'm adding this part, but, like, she was talking about how the doctor comes in and says, scoot down, scoot down, scoot down. And I was dying because as cis women who have gone to the gynecologist a lot, like, no matter how far down the table you prep yourself to go, like, the doctor's always like, scoot down more. And it's fucking awkward as shit, right? So I was thinking about these moments where women were like no cis man in that room is gonna understand that joke mm-hmm. or that part of the joke. Like, I was dying laughing, and like the men in the room were not. That just passed by them, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there's some value in having those kinds of very specific, like, I see you, right? This has been a theme in this podcast.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a talk from, I forget her name, Bree Code, where she mentions in passing, like, why isn't there a slot in the bathtub for people who shave their legs to put their feet in so that you can actually, like, shave your legs without, like, doing that weird, awkward, like, you know, dance that we do in the bathtub to try to shave your legs.
Yep.
So anyways, okay, so that was lovely. And then I went to see Ozzo Motley, which is a 6-piece fusion band from L.A. And I say fusion, which is a cheesy word, but, like, literally they are. Like, it's Latinx and Chicano and hip-hop and rock. Super high energy, very dancey. They're fucking amazing. Like, if you ever get a chance to see them, see them. And their opening band was Banda La Maravillosa. Sorry if I said that wrong. And they were delightful as well. But the reason I'm bringing this up is that they brought a woman on stage who was dancing just from the audience and a couple of people. But the first woman, she's dancing. And so they are all wearing white T-shirts. And there's, like, I don't know, 15 of them on stage. It was a lot of people. And they surround her. Like, they literally surround her. It's just a bunch of dudes around this woman dancing on stage. It was like a fucking SNL sketch. It was so horrifying to watch that I was like, holy crap. But that passed, and she seemed okay. So the thing that brings both of these together is that both Liz and one of the musicians at one of the Ozzo Motley musicians at the end of the show said, enjoy yourself because this means we still have hope. Liz said, you spent the night laughing, which means you still have hope that the world isn't a dumpster fire. And the fact that Ozzo Motley on the same night said the same thing, like, you're here dancing and enjoying this because you're still human and, like, we're still here together. And I really liked that a lot. And I feel like I'm glad I had that night, right? Like, so much of what we do is exhausting and so much of the news is exhausting. And how do we find these moments where, like, you're just having fun for at least an hour or something, right? You're doing something that makes you feel connected and hopeful. So,
you know what will help you keep that feeling alive, Anita? Doing a hip hop dance class with me.
All right.
Okay.
I'll just, we should live stream it too so we can just embarrass the fuck out of ourselves.
People, you heard her agree. Don't let her back out.
All right, y'all, that is our show. You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. I'd like to shout out our amazing, generous Feminist Frequency Radio backers. Drip is Kickstarter's brand new subscription-based crowdfunding platform. Help us keep bringing this podcast to you every week by joining the Feminist Frequency community. We've even got some great rewards for you, so pitch in now at d.rip/femfreak. If you're enjoying the show, we have a small favor to ask. Please leave us a review on iTunes because it really helps spread the word about our show. I don't know why, algorithms or something, but please do it. And, you know, tell all of your friends, you know, when you're out dancing at the club and shit. Because last week you were at the ballpark and this week you're at the club. So, yeah. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts, including our Star Trek Discovery podcast at feministfrequency.com. Next week, we're going to have a very special guest, so be sure to tune in for that. And we want to hear from you, so hit us up on Twitter. Carolyn, where are you at?
I'm at Carolyn Michelle.
Ebony?
I am at Fishmonster.
Cool. I'm at Anita Sarkeesian. And Ebony's at Ebony Astor. I was just going to pass that one, but I was like, no, some people might want to be like, yo, hey, what's up, lady?
They know where to find me.
That's true. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music. We'll see you all next week.
Bye.
Bye, champs.